This is an ABC podcast.
I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on ABC Radio National, where we're still doing what we've done for nearly 40 years, examining what really matters in this changing world.
It's a power grab in advance.
And it felt fugitive, an alternative.
And people were willing to take risks.
Hear it now with four brand new episodes each week on the ABC Listen app.
Yes, I remember it well. I think it was 1956, November. I was 12, and a schoolmaster, this was London, announced the birth of a new magazine. It was called New Scientist, and it cost one shilling, say 50 cents to you. It was rather grey, with lots of black print, and we each received one there in class. And now, nearly 70 years later, it's just about the only science magazine we have. Yes, The Science Show, and this time last year we had three science magazines, that is. But now Cosmos and The Skeptic have gone, still online in some form, but no more in your hand. New Scientist thrives, though, and it's available by post should you choose. The editor, Catherine DeLange, is with me now.
My name is Catherine DeLange, and I'm the editor of New Scientist.
By the way, where did your name come from?
It's Dutch. Ah. But confusingly, my mother's French, and this name sounds French, but it's my father's name, who is English, but the name is Dutch.
Ah, international. That's good. How long have you been editors? About a year?
It's coming up to 2 years in January.
How did you find it when you first moved into the chair?
Well, I've been at New Scientist for probably the best part of 10 years in various jobs. So on the one hand, it was very familiar. And on the other hand, you know, it's a lot of responsibility because I care deeply about New Scientist. I feel very invested. I know my colleagues very, very well, so it's not the same as kind of getting a new job somewhere and walking into the building, and I feel a lot of pressure to do a good job for them as well as for our readers.
Now, you said there lots of them are very, very smart, and what's your background in science to keep up with them?
To be honest, I don't think I can keep up with them. My colleagues are extremely smart, and yes, if you sat in some of the meetings that we have, the ideas meetings, they go all over the place. But my background is in human sciences. I studied human sciences at university at UCL here in London. And then I did a master's in science communication at Imperial because I knew finishing my undergraduate, it was a great course which covers all sorts of different subjects, from sort of psychology to anthropology to genetics to biochemistry. And I just loved learning about all these different things. And I couldn't imagine myself then going on to work, you know, in a lab and studying one thing for the rest of my career. I just love the breadth and I love to be constantly learning new things about all sorts of science. So when I found out there was a course, you know, science communication, a master's course that could lead you into that profession, it felt perfect for me.
Well, I've quoted it before, but Francis Crick, the great Nobel Prize winner and the most intelligent and lovely person in the pair Watson and Crick, DNA and so on, said there is scientific information and there is gossip. And what he meant was ideas. So he's talking about the same sort of thing as you. One of the really interesting things about the magazine at the moment is the headlines are very enticing, but they don't disappoint. I'm looking at one at the moment. Cockatoos like to move it and move it. Of course, the Australian audience will know that sulfur-crested cockatoos who dance, but why do they like to dance? And there in the article is some idea of what it's based on. The other thing about it is the magazine I'm talking about is it has this tremendous range from the news part through to the ideas, as Francis Crick would insist. How do you maintain that wonderful balance?
The very boring answer is that it's just in the way that our teams are set up. So we have a news team and we have a features team who are doing very different jobs. And actually, increasingly, they're working together because I think that there are some synergies there. The clue is in the title of the magazine, New Scientist. We don't publish anything that we think that you could read elsewhere unless there's something that we can add to it. And so everything that we do is focused on the cutting edge. So the news team are looking for those very, very new findings and discoveries and adding insight and analysis to those for our readers. And our features team have the very difficult job of finding several stories every single week that can hold 2,500 words and can be told in a really engaging and an entertaining way, but that again are really new ideas. But that's where we get more of those big ideas in. And in fact, sometimes we have scientists who might have their own big idea who write for us. Yeah, so we have that balance and we have that space to explore all sorts of ideas. And as you say, get that balance between the findings and the discoveries and then actually taking those further and thinking, what do they mean? And maybe pulling together lots of discoveries into one of these features.
And you also have fun. I remember an article by you about how to cook pastries.
Yeah, I love baking. I love baking, and so baking is a science. And so for a while, we did a baking column and I wrote about all sorts of baking tricks until I realised that I probably couldn't keep up with that. So yes, we do have fun. And, you know, I think what's really important in my eyes is that we are not here to educate. You don't have to read New Scientist. It's not the curriculum. We are here to entertain people and we want people to enjoy it and learn things along the way. And so, yeah, we do like to have fun. You know, every week we look at the mag. You know, one of the things I look at is, was it fun enough? Or were we being too straight with everything? And can we inject a little bit more humour? And, you know, as we're growing internationally, we have to be quite aware of, does the humour work for different audiences? Do the Americans understand our jokes and vice versa?
So. Americans don't understand your jokes. But you've got a nice cartoon there as well at the end, which is beautiful. But what about Australia? Now we have no physical science magazines. Cosmos is gone and The Skeptic is gone. There is, of course, Australian Geographic, which has scientific ingredients. But you're on your own out there.
Yeah.
Well, and you've got at least one, probably more, science writers.
We do, and they're fantastic, and we would like to do more, and actually to have reporters on that side of the world, and, you know, we can look at some of the exciting science and technology that's happening in India and in China, and, you know, I can see that there is an increasingly important role for staff out there.
Especially in these turbulent times, not just in Britain, not just in Australia, but around the world. No one is leading the policy ideas regarding science. It's just being buffeted in the wake of everything else, I would have thought. I don't know how many people in Britain would be able to name a science minister, for example. But nonetheless, the editorials I see done by someone perhaps in this very building, the Royal Society, about the collapse of support in many areas for science itself.
Yeah, that's why it's such an important time for publications like ours, because there is a lack of political will and funding, and there's also a lot of misinformation. There's a mistrust in expertise. And so I think that there's an increasingly important role for publications like ours. And, you know, I know we've been talking mainly about the print magazine, but I think we have a huge opportunity with digital to reach a wider audience and engage more people who aren't even necessarily thinking that what they're looking for is science, but people who are just curious about the world that we live in. And we can bring, it sounds a bit naff, but the kind of the awe and wonder that we experience every day reporting on these stories, we can bring them to a lot more people with digital. And so I think that it is an exciting opportunity at the same time to sort of widen our reach at a time when you could say science is under threat.
How do you balance what you do in that regard? You've got online, yeah, sure, but that's an extension of the magazine itself. But also you've got public events. You're almost like the British Science Festival used to be and its equivalent in Australia. You've got sages on stages doing their bit.
We do. It's coming up fast. New Scientist Live, which is our absolutely huge extravaganza. We call it the world's best festival of science and ideas. About 25,000 people will attend. And for anyone who cannot be in London, you can also live stream all of the talks, 2 days of incredible speakers and a schools day dedicated for secondary school students to come and sort of inspire them about getting into science. So that's very important to us. Yes, so we have that. We have our own podcast. So I encourage your listeners, if they're interested, to have a listen. It's called The World, the Universe and Us. And that's a weekly podcast looking at a few sort of big stories happening in science. And now I would challenge the idea that digital is just a sort of extension of the magazine. I think that traditionally it has been, but increasingly we're thinking about, I believe that the audiences are actually different. You know, there's people who love to read things in print, and we love that, and we will continue to do that for them. And then there's an audience who we know that, especially younger people, they consume their news and their media differently. And I'm excited about trying to give them a flavour of what we do as well. And I think that we need to forget this idea that digital is just an extension of print and think, how do we try and satisfy those audiences as well as satisfying the print audiences, which is a lot. But that's what we're trying to do. So it's pretty busy.
Busy indeed. Finally, what are your plans?
So the big plans at the moment are what I was just alluding to, which is thinking about how do we create a digital experience that is as good as the print experience? Because I think people understand how the print magazine fits into their life. They might get it every week. They might buy it in the shops. It might come through their letterbox, but they know what it is. You know, you can feel the quality and the care that goes into it. We know that some people start at the back and read towards the front. Some people want to digest the news. Other people want to go straight for the chunkier features in the middle. And that's a very tangible experience for them. And I don't think that at the moment we managed to do that for digital. So I'd like us to see if we can recreate an experience for the people who want it on digital to feel just as good and as classy as the print version. So that's one big challenge at the moment. And how do we appeal to a younger audience online? And at the same time, thinking about those people who already know us and love us, how can we give them more? And how can it feel a bit less transactional? You know, I'm going to give you my subscription money and you're going to give me my content. Can we have more relationship? Can we build more of a community? And we haven't spoken about AI and how that's changing the media, but I think increasingly having a sense of a two-way conversation and a community with real human beings is going to have a lot of value. And so I would like to see us extend our reach to new audiences, but also deepen that connection with the loyal audiences that we already have.
How do you do that? How do you listen to what your readers say?
Well, at the moment, we probably don't do it well enough. I mean, people write me letters, and I try and get back to everybody, not always in a timely fashion, I will add. But I think there's so many things that we can do. There is new platforms now to have discussions, things like Discord that people use, especially for podcasts. We don't, for instance, allow commenting on our stories, a very basic thing that we could do to add for people to be able to have a conversation. We can create forums. And we're also looking at, this is a work in progress, but we're looking at, could we create a sense of, for those people who are really engaged with us and engaged with science, more of a membership feel where we maybe have exclusive events, whether in person or online, where people can have that much more intimate connection and give their feedback and meet our editors and speak to the reporters and give their feedback in that way.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Catherine DeLange, editor of New Scientist magazine, and we met at the Royal Society building by St James's Park in London. And here now is one of their recent stories that I've not seen anywhere else. Wallabies being transported in the South Pacific 12,000 years ago in a canoe. The scientist involved is Dylan Gaffney, whom I met at his college, Hartford, in Oxford. Tell me from the beginning, what put you on the track of going to excavate and look and examine the evidence that you wrote up about the transportation of, in this case, wallabies?
This was part of a project, the first project actually in West Papua, the western part of New Guinea, so just north of Australia. The first project there in 30 years archaeologically, and we were looking for the earliest dispersals of humans, earliest dispersals out of Africa into Eurasia and then into the Pacific area.
How did you know where to look?
Finding sites in these islands is very challenging, mostly because they're rainforested, so there's a lot of forest cover that we have to deal with. You can't just go out into the islands and sort of look. You have to be very strategic about finding these places. And so we look for specific geological zones, often limestone zones, where we can find caves. And in those caves, it's usually a good place to find sediment that has built up over tens of thousands of years and where people have been living in these, inside these caves.
So where was this one?
The cave in question is called Malolo, which is right inside Waigeo Island's inland sea. So Waigeo Island is this large island off the coast of New Guinea. It has this big bay in the middle of it, a big saltwater bay, and in that bay is a cave called Malolo, and that's where we dug for these artifacts.
So what did you find as you dug down?
When we dig back through time in these caves, we dig back centimetre by centimetre, And we find things like hearths where people have been making fires inside the cave. We find stone tools, which people have been using for cutting, butchery, these kind of activities. We find animal bones, and in this case, tens of thousands of animal bones, as well as sometimes organic artifacts such as bone tools and so on.
And how is it you put a picture together that there had been transportation, that's 12,800 years ago, of wallabies? What were the signs that put together to make that story?
So in examining animal bones that we found from these caves, we look at them under the microscope, essentially. At the university, we take them, look under a series of different microscopes to identify the species of these bones. So then we know what animals people are hunting, the diet of people in the past. And so we can quite precisely determine the species, the kinds of animals, and therefore we identify a species of wallaby called Dorcopsis.
The wallaby, now I automatically think of Australian wallabies. Was there sufficient land bridges so that you got movement of these animals across?
One interesting thing about Waigeo Island is that it was always disconnected from New Guinea. We know right back through time into the Pleistocene, into the Ice Ages, even 50,000 years ago, it was always disconnected from New Guinea. So therefore we know the fact that we find wallabies on Waigeo Island and they're native to New Guinea, it implies to us that they've been transported somehow across water from New Guinea to Waigeo. And in the case of our excavations, we argued that this was translocation by humans actually moving these animals.
And was that actually, as it said in one of the articles, the first time they had evidence of the transport of larger animals in canoes?
This is evidence for the first translocation westwards from New Guinea into the islands of Indonesia, what is today Indonesia. But there is some evidence from the Bismarck Archipelago in Papua New Guinea, which is even earlier, and this is about 20,000 years ago, although the dates are a little bit broad in terms of there is some wiggle room in those dates. But it's about 20,000 years ago in which we see humans translocating couscous, essentially possums, from the mainland of New Guinea into the Bismarck Archipelago.
And were these creatures, possums or wallabies, alive or dead?
We speculate that they were captured and reared and taken as pets, released into these islands, perhaps released deliberately to create a population of animals that could then be hunted. So quite a strategic activity. We argue they were released live because we find these animals cropping up in the archaeological sequences again and again. So it's not just one animal that's been translocated dead. It's a live population, we argue.
Have you ever imagined what it was like with a canoe, a fair old trip with a bouncy animal like a wallaby on it?
Yeah, sort of like a prehistoric Noah's Ark or something like that. Well, it's quite possible. And we do have ethnographic, so modern anthropological observations of people who live around rainforests in Borneo and the Amazon. And people there do carry around pet animals. They do capture wild animals, rear them. In the parts of West Papua that I've worked, every village that you go to has pet animals from the forest. There's one village that I've been to where every house has a pet cockatoo. And so it's very feasible, and we can see examples from the ethnography of how people would have captured these animals and then put them in their boats, taken them to new islands, perhaps even transported them deliberately for trading, a prehistoric wildlife trade.
Of course, there was a story 4,000 years ago that dogs, which became dingoes, were brought across from Macassar by boat 4,000 years ago or something like that. That still stands up.
Yeah, so the examples of canids, so dogs and later pigs, as well as chickens, these are all animals that eventually disperse through Southeast Asia into the Pacific area. In the case of dingoes, these are the animals that do get to Australia, whereas pigs, for some reason, do not get to Australia. But this is part of a later stage of this process, and so our evidence is giving us a much earlier window into this long-term history of humans interacting with animals and moving them.
It's a fascinating story, going back, as I said, nearly 13,000 years. Are you going to go back there shortly?
Well, I've just returned from the islands, from a month of excavations in the West Papuan Islands, and we are every year going back, finding new sites, digging new sites, uncovering new artifacts and new insights into the lives of these people in the past.
With the help of Indonesian archaeologists as well?
Yeah, so an excellent team of local and international researchers. So we have researchers from Australian universities, British, New Zealand universities, but we have a core team of Papuan archaeologists and anthropologists that we work with who grew up in the region and know the local archaeology expertly.
Final question. You actually described wallabies as coming from Papua New Guinea. Was this a time when there was some sort of connection on land with Australia so that we share the origin?
Yeah, so until about 8,000 years ago, New Guinea and Australia were connected as one continent called Sahul. So we know that New Guinea and Australia shared movements of animals and earlier in time people as well. So this was one continent that was connected, but the offshore islands like the Bismarck Archipelago and what is today Indonesia, they were always disconnected. They were always islands.
A long way to travel from Oxford for you, but never mind.
That's part of the fun, isn't it? To go to places very far away and spend time there, spend months excavating.
I was with Dr. Dylan Gaffney, who before going to Hertford College, Oxford, was with the University of Otago in Dunedin, New Zealand. And another southern paleontologist who's moved north to Oxford is Dr. Roger Close, and he's trying to solve a mega mystery. How do you work out a pattern of evolution across the ages and the globe when so many fossils are buried in inconvenient places, under forests or deep granite?
Where do you go for your digs?
I have done some digs in the past, including in Australia. So I grew up in Melbourne. I spent about 10 years digging up dinosaurs and other terrestrial animals in Inverloch with the dig that's run by Pat Vickers-Rich and Tom Rich at the Museum of Victoria.
Dinosaur Cove.
I went to Dinosaur Cove for a scouting trip once, but I spent a lot of time digging up fossils at Inverloch on the beach at Flat Rocks.
How exciting. And how did that take you to Oxford?
So I first came over to Oxford to do a postdoc after my PhD back in 2013, and I've stayed here ever since.
What's your research?
So I'm interested in using big databases of information about the fossil record to try and understand how modern biodiversity came to exist over deep time. So there's obviously a spectacular number of species alive today, but at some point in the very distant past, there were none. So I'm trying to understand how this diversity came to exist over deep time.
And how will those fossils illustrate it for you? Genetics I could understand, but there are no genes down there.
Yeah, so the fossil record is our only direct evidence for ancient patterns of biodiversity and how biodiversity varied across time and space. And so it has an awful lot to tell us about how biodiversity came to exist and also, therefore, the processes that give rise to biodiversity and regulate it over extended periods of time.
If you are looking at it from the sky, you might think that what nature might like to do is just consolidate, almost keeping the immigrants out, in other words, so you just build your stable population instead of having all that multiplication that produces uncertainty, perhaps.
That's definitely something that you can study in the fossil record, and there are some spectacular examples of these kind of natural immigration experiments. So the Great American Biotic Interchange, for example, which resulted in species from North and South America mixing together, that resulted in massive disruption to ecosystems.
So where are you looking and what are you finding so far?
My main work is essentially reassessing the kind of classical interpretation of the fossil record. So paleontologists have got an awful lot to offer in terms of understanding how biodiversity came to exist. But in the past, paleontologists have tended to focus on understanding diversity through time by essentially tallying up all of the species that are known for each interval of geological time. But some work that I've done has shown that you really can't take these global diversity curves at face value because the spatial extent of the fossil record, so how fossils are distributed across the Earth's surface, varies an awful lot through geological time. So, for example, on land, for tetrapods, terrestrial tetrapods like mammals and birds and reptiles and so on, the extent of the distribution of fossil localities across the Earth's surface essentially decays exponentially as you go further back in time. And this is because sediments that contain these fossils become progressively more buried and eroded and so lost to the fossil record. And so a kind of literal reading of this fossil record of tetrapods suggested to paleontologists that diversity had been increasing more or less exponentially to the present day. But I've shown that if you focus on really well-studied, well-understood regions of the globe and compare them across time and space in a more robust way, this exponential increase essentially disappears, and you have long periods of tens of millions of years of no change in diversity on average. But then you sometimes get major increases associated with profound ecological disruption. So, for example, after the end Cretaceous extinction that wiped out the dinosaurs, there was a very rapid rebound in diversity to maybe three or four times the previous level as mammals explosively radiated into the niches that were left vacant by dinosaurs.
Yeah, there was space. Now, I want to give you a thought experiment leading from what you've just said. If you listen to Mike Archer and a couple of others, they have worked with people who are examining the Earth from the sky, in other words, satellites. Because the idea is you can look at, say, Riversleigh, which is in northern Queensland. It's so rich in all those monsters that Archer and his team have been digging up for some years. And you can see signs of where the next digs should be. And you can do that to some extent with human remains as well, where people have been. And one of the problems is because you cannot recruit students to do paleontology or archaeology, especially because the archaeology is deemed to be a humanities course, it's twice as expensive to do, and so you're not getting the students. So Archer and people in archaeology are desperately looking for your successors, may I say, Dr. Close. How do you solve that problem?
I think it's about educating the students who are coming into the university system. If they're going into a geology degree, for instance, it's not just a kind of direct course to the mining industry, for instance. There's an awful lot of primary research that you can do in the field, and it also sets you up with all sorts of transferable skills that are useful for all sorts of different industries.
Do you think that is going to work, or has it not been said already? Because by the time you've actually trained your paleontologists and trained your archaeologists, it might be 5 or 10 years from now.
I don't think we're having this problem in the UK. I mean, it might be a bit of a different situation in Oxford because we only take about 30 students each year. And so we might not be witnessing the scale of the problem you might see in Australia if you have much larger intakes of undergraduates. So we can be a lot more selective.
And you think perhaps there might be a few spare archaeologists and paleontologists coming from America, given the circumstances?
I think that's highly likely.
Finally, what next for you with your work?
So actually, the work that I'm planning over the next few years kind of touches on the work that Mike Archer is planning on doing. So I'm interested in understanding how the distribution of species across latitudes changed over deep time. So today, one of the most striking features of how species are distributed across Earth's surface is something that we call the latitudinal diversity gradient. So it's essentially describing how diversity declines from the equator to the poles. But at some points in the past when Earth's climate was really hot, the fossil record appears to show that this kind of gradient of diversity didn't exist, perhaps because species couldn't survive at hot equatorial latitudes. But the trouble is that this pattern might be confounded with the way that fossils are sampled across the globe. So some of the recent work that I've done in marine animals over the last few hundred million years, for instance, shows that the peak of diversity across paleolatitudes essentially tracks Europe and North America from the southern hemisphere across the equator around the end Permian mass extinction and then into the northern hemisphere paleotemperate regions. And this seems highly unlikely. I think this is primarily a signal of bias. So the work that I'm going to do is to try and collect a lot more data about the kinds of potentially fossil-bearing deposits that are out there to see whether it might just be because we're missing some components of the fossil fauna from these low-latitude regions. And I think that there's potentially a role for this kind of satellite imagery in that.
And a role for the new students waiting by to follow you up.
Absolutely.
There I go, trying to recruit fossil hunters again. Well, we need them. Dr. Roger Close, paleontologist in Oxford. This is The Science Show, and at this stage, I'd really like to play Helen Reddy. I am woman. Even the words suit. This is The Science Show on Radio National.
I am strong. I am invincible. I am woman.
Yes, she is woman. Her name is Star Vartan, and she's a paradox. She sounds American, but she is from Australia, and is called Star, which seems to be a trifle flamboyant, but turns out to be the old-fashioned spelling with two R's and an E. And her book is called The Stronger Sex. That's woman. How come?
In certain respects, that's absolutely true. There's a whole bunch of categories that female bodies have exhibited tons of strength, both scientifically and in practical terms in the real world.
Give me an example.
Well, if you look at muscular endurance, that's something that you can look at both in the lab and you see in the real world as well. In the lab, there is a wonderful researcher called Sandra Hunter who did some tests about 20 years ago. She began this pioneering work where she looked at how long someone could induce a muscular contraction. And she had male and female college students, and she had brawny big guys and nerdy guys and women and all of the people you might find on a college campus. And they lifted about 50% of the max possible weight that that person could lift. And she found that men sort of tapped out after about 10 minutes of weightlifting, and the female subjects in general could go half hour, 45 minutes, even one of them went to an hour. So that pointed her research to understanding how there's a tremendous amount of muscular endurance capacity in women's bodies, not lifting that max weight a few times, but lifting lower weights for a much longer period of time. And that is probably why there's such wonderful endurance runners and endurance athletes that are women who are showing up and beating men, even though they have less support, less training, and less experience. In the real world, we actually see perfect examples of this, because if you look around the world, you see women doing that repetitive weight work, like carrying water, gathering firewood, tanning hides, all those things that just require endurance strength. And I think that is a really good example of a type of strength that's really been overlooked.
What about the fairly famous one of enduring pain?
Pain is a very tricky subject. I almost didn't want to cover it in the book at all because pain is subjective. So anybody who researches pain is going to be dealing with not just the physical aspect of what they're dealing with in front of them, whoever the person is, but that person's entire history of what they've been taught about what pain means and how they should be treated and what they should expect from it. So it's a little complicated. Women experience more pain over different parts of their lives. So there's reproductive pain with your menstrual cycle. If you have a child and you go through pregnancy and childbirth, that's obviously a big one. And that process of experiencing pain starts young and you get a lot of practice at it. And what scientists have found is that among all human beings, male, female, any gender, the people that have the most practice with pain are the best at dealing with it. So in general, women have more practice at dealing with their pain. So that's why we probably see that women are more pain tolerant. But whether men or women actually experience pain differently isn't really yet known. There's some really interesting neurobiology. There's ways to try to bypass some of that cultural conditioning we've heard. So if you're a little boy and you've heard you should suck it up and not complain about your pain, versus you're a little girl and you're told that you can express your pain, all of that influences how one experiences pain and communicates it to the world and communicates it to a researcher. So is there a way to bypass some of this? Yes, by looking at the brain. And some of those tests have shown that probably it's a little bit closer than we think in terms of male and female bodies probably experience pain similarly. Because if you think about it evolutionarily, any human body is going to experience pain. They need to be able to handle it and move on or rest if necessary.
Star, how do you know all this? Did you study it particularly as an academic exercise? I know your grandmother was involved somehow.
No, I'm not an academic. I am a science journalist. And so this book really came out of my experience growing up in New York's Hudson Valley. I lived on a property with my grandma. It was just she and me, and we were back in the woods running a huge garden, building stone walls. She chopped the wood, I stacked it. And I really had this incredible experience while I was growing up of testing my own strength and not having a lot of people around telling me what I could or couldn't do or should or shouldn't do. And my grandmother just was old school. She made a list and said, these are your chores for the day. And then I had to go figure out how to deal with them. So, you know, being a kid, of course, I wanted to get my chores over quickly so I could go play in the woods and read books. And so I would pile the wheelbarrow extra full of those logs that I had to pile. And sometimes it was too full and I couldn't quite manage the wheelbarrow and it fell over. And that's how I learned my own strength as a child, by direct experience. It wasn't somebody saying, oh, this is how you should do a thing, or this is how you should move a rock. And so that really carried through my whole life. As I became a science journalist, I realized that I had heard a lot of things about my own body, and my own experience in my own body of trying different sports and running and climbing trees was not what I had been told by other people. So there was this contradiction between what I'd been told and what I experienced in my own body and knew from testing my own strength since I was a kid.
So what's the big picture in this 2025, 2026 world? Because we're always warned, very much to do with human behavior and psychology and such like, that you need really big numbers to get some sort of clear idea of what is the case, because there's such a range of behavior, such a range of ability in the human population. What's your essential message on what we need to look at when it comes to the stronger sex, so-called?
That's a really important point. It's definitely something I wrote about a lot. So we talk about male and female bodies, and there's a tremendous overlap. We all know women who do have tremendous upper body strength. Generally, men tend to have more, but there's the human diversity among populations is huge. And that's a really important thing to keep in mind, because when you get to the highest levels of athletics, or even when you're in science and you're testing groups of people, keeping that in mind is very important. And we also have lots of gender diverse people as well. There's intersex people, many of whom are intersex and don't know it. That's not something that we test for in advance. There's people who are trans who are really at the forefront of challenging some of the ideas that we have, not just in gender expression, but in the science of it, because we can learn amazing things from what hormones are doing to their bodies. And how we understand that on a population level can really help all people and all human bodies, because these specific examples, we can then understand larger groups of people a little bit better. And so some of the most interesting advances that I've seen coming out of some of this new research, because a lot of this research is new, especially on the female bodies, as we all know, there's been wonderful books written about this. There's been a real dearth of research into female bodies medically. Exercise science, about 6% of all exercise science studies have ever been done on female bodies. There's just a tremendous amount more to learn. And also then with bodies that are outside of that gender binary as well. That's all great information for scientists.
How much are you concerned about the politics of this? Because we've seen, you mentioned trans just now, immense negative reactions from some quarters about such things. And here you are with your new book, The Stronger Sex, a challenge in the title straight away. Are you in any way foreboding about the launch of the book and what happens next?
I was a little bit concerned. I definitely think that this is the kind of material that could be used by some people to advance certain agendas. I'm old enough to have experienced that politics is temporary and people really get very excited about certain subjects. And then we move on and 10 years later, it seems like not a big deal. And I do think that's what's, maybe I'm too hopeful. I do think that's what's going to happen here. I had several people who are trans read the book and contribute their ideas and thoughts in terms of how to make the ideas in it inclusive, because I don't think that studying female bodies, which is incredibly important, should be fodder or ammunition to not study other bodies. I think what we need to do is take all of the information that we've lost or missed so far in not studying female bodies and expand that idea to say, let's make sure we do study all of the bodies. You know, that includes disabled people and all kinds of other ways of being human, which are traditionally not thought of when we're doing science. And I think there's a lot of scientists that are aware of that as well, because they see the potential of what they could learn from these, say, non-traditional bodies.
Yes, one of the most staggering examples, as I've mentioned on the Science Show many times, Helen McConnell in Melbourne, just about 30 years ago, it was the first published evidence, although some had been, in fact, covered up, well, many decades, even centuries ago, that is the clitoris and its size and its function. And she, being a pioneer of urology, published the results something like 27 years ago. And that's so recent and changed attitudes dramatically. But going back to what you were saying just before about some of the history, is there any information in anthropology of various people around the world over the different years where the male-female roles were somewhat different and rather along the lines of the stronger sex that you depict in your book?
Yeah, I think some of your listeners might know about the fact that they have reassessed many of the graves of Iron Age, Bronze Age warriors that were just assumed to be male because they had all these wonderful hunting and war implements in their graves. And then they did DNA tests when that became more common and available and found that some of these bodies were female bodies. And this has been repeated in a whole bunch of different categories. A lot of things that were assumed based on the contents of a grave or based on the situation that a body was found in, the sex of the individual was assumed. And now there's a lot of revision and thinking about that. One of the most interesting that has come out recently, and I spoke with the researcher who wrote this in Seattle a couple months ago, Carol Wall Scheffler, worked on showing how actually about 50% of all hunters have been and continue to be women. So women are out there doing that, what we think of as quintessential male body work of hunting down animals. And the idea that there were women sitting around a fire with babies and the men were out hunting all the time is just not accurate if you look at the broad swath of humanity. Are there cultures where that might have happened? Sure. But for the most part, the best people for the job would be doing the job, whatever that job is. If that's gathering plant medicines, if that's tracking animals, if that's hunting and killing animals, we didn't have enough people to separate things out by something as arbitrary as gender. And the other thing worth remembering in that is that hunting an animal depends on the animal, depends on the skill that you need to do that work. So in some animal hunting, you need to run really far, you need to run really fast, and you need to be very accurate with a spear. Those are three different skills. Other animal hunting, you need to be quiet and stalk that animal. You maybe need to create some kind of way to capture the animal. So when you talk about something like hunting, oh, men always hunted. Well, hunted what and how? And how do we know that men hunted in the past? We don't. We actually made that assumption, and this recent research has shown that for the most part, women are hunting too.
The book is The Stronger Sex by Star Vartan, who lives on the south coast of New South Wales, and her book is published next week. Very brave. And so to a sad farewell, Dr. Jim Peacock rose to the top of global science and was the head of CSIRO Plant Industry, was the Prime Minister's top scientist one year, and President of the Academy of Science here. He died last week, and here is his voice, heard so often on The Science Show.
It can cause very severe crop failures. It's vectored by a mite, and I suppose the extent of damage that is done to a crop really depends upon the number of mites and the weather, etc., all those things. I know around Winnipeg, for example, I've heard of crop losses of 30% or more. I think there's just one or two that have been recorded where it's near total loss.
One of our greatest scientists, Dr. Jim Peacock, look at his record and be astonished. And by coincidence, the Prime Minister's Science Prizes are next week. Vale. And we end this Science Show with another example of that fight against pests killing crops or wild plants. Let's join Tim Entwistle at the Botanic Garden at Mount Annan.
I'm in the plant nursery at the Australian Botanic Garden at Mount Annan, which is part of the Botanic Gardens of Sydney. And it's where I found Brett Summerall, Chief Scientist and Director of Science at the Botanic Gardens. But Brett, you've been here for 37 years, starting as a plant pathologist.
Yes, so I had responsibility for not only doing research in plant diseases, plant biosecurity and the like, but also diagnosing any problems that might pop up in any of the three gardens. So it's a fantastic job to start with.
And the nursery out here at Mount Annan is the largest nursery, I imagine, in the whole of the botanic gardens at the moment. And the ones we're surrounded by here are susceptible to a particular pest.
Yeah, so most of the plants surrounding us are species that are critically impacted by a fungal disease called myrtle rust, which came into Australia first detected in about April of 2010. And over the 15 and a bit year period since it's been here, it's spread up and down the coast of Australia, blown across to Lord Howe Island, to New Caledonia, to New Zealand, and is slowly working its way, and recently was detected in the top part of WA. So it's moved around and it's had a serious impact on a range of species.
But presumably not on the plants around us here today. So why are you growing all these plants susceptible to that rust?
So most of these species that were surrounded, things like the native guava and scrub turpentine, are almost functionally extinct in the wild. So the impact of the disease has been so severe that the plants either cannot survive, they die, or they cannot reproduce. So they're not able to, the flowers get affected by the disease and seeds are aborted. So we've brought all of this material back to the gardens and a range of other gardens in order to protect it, conserve it, and then try to work out how we can maybe do things that allow us to then reintroduce it back out into the wild.
So are there resistant forms, or can you create resistant forms?
So the work we've done so far has shown that particularly in a number of these species that we have around here, that so what we're looking for is to see which individuals are resistant or tolerant of the disease, understand their genetics and using genomic tools, isolate markers and then breed those individuals up and then start to produce seed from those so that we can then use that material to reintroduce it back into the wild, hopefully building up resistance in the natural population.
And the problem here, a rust, is a kind of fungus. This is exactly what you've been working on for 37 and more years.
Yeah. My research interest is in particularly on fungal diseases of plants, and I've really focused on fungal diseases of Australian plants and understanding about their biology, their taxonomy and identifying species, but also looking at ways in which we can fight the problems that they cause.
Now, I know there's one that you've been working on even more closely. There's a genus called Fusarium. You were out early this year warning everyone, and quite as often as you could, in eastern Australia about a beetle, in fact, though, a beetle that was perhaps carrying this disease. I think it's from Asia, but it was coming via Western Australia.
Yes, so over in Perth, people may be aware that the Polyphagus shothole borer, which is a tiny, tiny beetle, about 2 millimetres long, so really difficult to detect, and that's been responsible associated with having something like 5,000 trees having to be removed from particularly the urban communities in Perth, and now they're moving to management rather than looking to eradicate the beetle. And so that's obviously a concern for us in the East Coast for this beetle and the associated fungus that it transmits to be moved to the East Coast. So it's a tricky combination of a beetle and a fungus to work with. The beetle infects the tree, but it also carries this fungus on its chewing implements, if you like, and that spreads up and down the water-carrying tissue of the trees and blocks it so it can't extract water from the soil.
So the beetle itself is not such a big problem. If the beetle was here but not the fungus, it wouldn't be so bad?
It wouldn't be so bad. It obviously has an impact because it's chewing away and boring into the tree, and that's going to have an impact. But it's really the impact then of the fungus moving, blocking the water conducting system in the tree, and that obviously those trees can't survive if they can't extract water from the soil.
Which reminds me a lot of many years ago, and it's still a potential problem, of course, Dutch elm disease, where we have a beetle in Australia that can carry that fungus, but the fungus, I understand, is not here, or I'm not sure.
It's a very similar situation where you have this beetle that carries the fungus. Fortunately, at this stage, we don't have the fungus in the country, particularly for those areas like parts of Victoria and the like, where there's lots of elm trees have directly been planted. So at this stage, just the beetle, it's a problem, but it's not a big problem.
So returning back to your Polyphagus shothole borer that's in Western Australia, presumably, though, that's going to get here at some point. Once it's here, do you move into a kind of different phase?
Yeah, it then becomes very much about a management phase if it does get here. You know, we know a range of plant species that are likely to be affected by the beetle and the fungal combination, figs and a range of different species, but there's a whole suite of our flora that we don't know what the impact will be. So that's a particular concern. So there's a lot of research happening, particularly in Western Australia, looking at different control options. Our task at this point in time is really about ramping up our opportunities for detection and making sure that if it does get over here, we detect it early and hit it early so that the beetle doesn't have a chance to establish here.
And do you want people to tell you if they find these little distinctive holes in their trees?
Yes, that's certainly the case. There's a biosecurity hotline run by the Department of Primary Industries and Rural Development, and people are well advised to look up the website for that and if they have anything of concern to report it through that hotline.
Now, let me just drop back to Fusarium, which is the fungus that's causing this problem. That's a group I know you've worked on for many years, possibly 37, maybe more.
Probably 42.
And I was interested to see a paper you wrote, I think it's quite a few years ago, with one of your colleagues, John Leslie, from Canberra State University, where I know you spent some time. And in that paper, you were sort of reviewing the situation, just quite a few years ago, but you said there could be between 9 and 1,000 species of Fusarium. I was curious to find out which end of that spectrum it's at.
At this stage, it's more towards the 1,000 end of it. 9 was a system that was in place in the 50s, but particularly as we start to work in both natural environments, different types of cropping plants, native plants and the like all around the world, we're finding a large number of species that are in this genus. And all of them have different attributes. All of them have different host plants that they like to attack. So some of them produce a range of toxins. Some are human pathogens. So it's a really important group of fungi that cause huge problems in agriculture, banana apocalypse, as they call it, where we have a particular strain of Fusarium that's causing Panama disease in bananas and spreading around lots of those big growing areas of bananas around the world is a classic example. But we also have a range of toxins that are produced in food stocks and the like. But more and more a problem, particularly in people who are immune suppressed, for get systemic Fusarium infections, and that can be fatal in those cases.
But the question that people get asked as taxonomists, of which I was once one as well, is the importance of taxonomy in identifying and classifying the species. And as you've said, you found there's perhaps closer to 1,000 than it was originally, only 9 many decades ago. How does that help in managing these diseases and perhaps understanding the problems?
It helps a lot. The accurate detection is really important, particularly in understanding new incursions. So we have a number of Fusarium pathogens that are not present in this country at the moment. So we need to know if, you know, they're coming in. So accurate diagnostics and detection is really important. And it's also about prioritizing where you put the resources into, making sure that you're attacking the real problems and not the smaller problems. And certainly we've found the specific strains that might cause a problem on different cultivars of whether it's wheat or bananas or whatever. It's important to have very accurate diagnostics so that you can prioritize where the money gets spent, where the activities are focused on and how you do it. So that really is. The taxonomy in this particular case is extremely important because it's very difficult otherwise to know how you would prioritize. The investment, the spend, and what you need to do in terms of breeding up a plant for resistance to a particular pathogen, you want to make sure it's the right pathogen.
Quite. And we are in the nursery here, and we're at the Australian Botanic Garden, Mount Annan, and it is a botanic garden. You've got connections and you're a professor at various universities, but you've worked your career in botanic gardens. I just wanted you to reflect back on why you've done that rather than universities and perhaps the benefits of working in a botanic garden.
It's interesting because I came to working at the Botanic Gardens back in 1989. I thought, oh, it'll be a good job for a couple of years. And here I still am in 2025. Botanic gardens are amazing places to do pure research, to do applied research, to have an impact, but also to be able to talk about the work that you do, to be able to engage with the community, with the public, to talk about how you do this, why plants are important. So I'm very passionate about telling the community, talking to the community about the importance of plants, the importance of fungi and those sorts of organisms, getting them to be enthused about it, to recognise that the world is not just green wallpaper. We do suffer from plant blindness. So it's a combination of being able to set up infrastructure that's really important, but do research that has a huge impact on the wonderful native ecosystems that we have here.
And I guess you still have the chance to supervise, which I know you do, lots of students, and to teach at the same time at universities.
Yeah, it's a little bit of best of both worlds. You get the community engagement, you get to work with a fantastic organisations that are doing all sorts of things, whether it's in education, science, or wonderful displays out in the gardens, but also have connections with the universities and to be able to influence the next generation of researchers.
Brett Summerall, Chief Scientist, Director of Science at Botanic Gardens of Sydney, here at Mount Annan Australian Botanic Garden, in a nursery that is pretty impressive, but I guess you always want more space in nurseries and always more facilities.
Absolutely. This, you know, we have some of the most fantastic plant science facilities out here at Mount Annan. We're interested in redeveloping our nursery site to bring it up to standard, particularly for addressing issues like plant conservation, but also the impact of climate change on plant conservation. So, yeah, that's the next big project.
Tim Entwistle, with Chief Scientist at the Royal Botanic Garden, Brett Summerill. Thanks to both. Next week, the Prime Minister's Prizes for Science and two Australian scientists in Cambridge, both called H-Squared. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher. I'm Robin Williams.